Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Oksana Smirichuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the main stories that were in the news this week.
Today, on behalf of President Trump, I bring you this assurance. The United States of America strongly supports NATO and will be unwavering in our commitment to this transatlantic alliance. And with regard to Ukraine, we must hold Russia accountable and demand that they honor the Minsk agreements, beginning by de-escalating the violence in eastern Ukraine.
The fact that Russia, as an aggressor, sitting in the Security Council as P5 member and misusing the veto right is a fundamental challenge to the whole United Nations system.
I was born in a country where anything was possible. We celebrated simple freedoms to live and to love.
This week, Ukraine commemorated the third anniversary of the violent end to the Euromaidan protests. They took place during the winter of 2013-2014 and caught the world's attention and imagination. Ukrainians were taking to the streets and facing riot police to defend their European choice. They succeeded in toppling an unpopular president, only to be invaded by neighboring Russia in a stealth war. According to Ukrainian prosecutors, 104 people were killed during the Euromaidan protests. They have become known as the Heavenly Hundred. Five of the youngest ones will now have their names on state scholarships: Ustim Holodnyuk, Nazar Vojtovich, Yuri Popravka, Roman Hurek, and Dmytro Maksimov. The scholarships were announced by Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, on February the 20th. That day, he met with families of all those who died and attended a special church service in their honor at the Mikhailivsky Monastery. Others gathered in Kyiv center at the site of the killings to remember the victims. A day earlier, on February the 19th, a group of nationalists had organized a rally in central Kyiv. They called their event the March of Distrust, expressed their negative views towards the president and government, and clashed with police. Others expressed their discontent more peacefully. One of the biggest complaints heard in Ukrainian society is that not enough has changed after the sacrifices people made during the protests and in the aftermath. Another complaint is that 3 years later, there is still no official memorial site for those who were killed. In a separate event this weekend, President Poroshenko announced the construction of a permanent memorial site for those killed on Maidan. Later in the show, we'll bring you a feature interview with Dr. Mikhailo Vinitsky, a Canadian professor who lives in Kyiv. He experienced the Euromaidan and is writing a book about it. Ukraine was one of the important topics discussed at the 53rd Munich Security Conference, which is an annual meeting of the world's top decision makers in the realm of international security. Ukraine's President Poroshenko was one of the speakers, along with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, US Vice President Michael Pence, Bono, Bill Gates, and around 500 others. Michael Pence's statements were probably the most reported. He stated that the US supports NATO unwaveringly. With regard to Ukraine, that we must continue to hold Russia accountable and continue to demand that Russia honors the Minsk agreements, beginning with de-escalating the violence in eastern Ukraine. He had a face-to-face meeting with President Poroshenko and afterwards tweeted that, in meeting with President Poroshenko, he underscored US support for Ukraine and full implementation of the Minsk Accords. Poroshenko also delivered a strong statement that was widely quoted. He stated that the message is simple: nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. Merkel reminded the audience that freedom of the press is one of the pillars of democracy. And Bono's statement was that our fate is a shared one, but which fate will it be? Ukraine's foreign minister, Pavlo Klimkin, called for United Nations reform this week. Klimkin is chairing the UN Security Council for the month of February. The council met on Tuesday, the 21st, to discuss unresolved conflicts in Europe. In his speech, Klimkin pointed out that paragraph 3 of Article 27 of the Charter requires that a party to a dispute shall abstain from voting. However, Russia continues to veto UN resolutions on Ukraine. He said that we need to urgently reform the Security Council in order to remove the veto power abuses. We'll post a link to the entire speech on our website. People in eastern Ukraine continue to suffer from war. The town of Avdiivka continued to experience heavy shelling this week. On Sunday the 20th, heavy rockets and firing went on for 10 hours. The next day, Kamyanka was shelled for 7 hours. Over the past week, 2 civilians were killed, one of them a child. The OSCE reported the freedom of movement was restricted on both sides of the contact line. 4 Ukrainian soldiers were killed, 2 died of their wounds, 30 were injured. Russia moves to recognize authorities controlling parts of Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia appears to be moving to normalize the status quo in the Donbas. On Saturday, Putin issued an order that documents issued by non-Ukrainian authorities that control parts of Donetsk and Luhansk now must be accepted in Russia. Passports, birth certificates, vehicle registration, diplomas, and other documents issued by the self-proclaimed governments in areas they called the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic will now allow people from those areas to travel to Russia and work or study there. Ukraine criticized this move as a violation of the Minsk agreements. The Kremlin released a statement that this move was temporary until a political settlement of the situation is reached. IT continues to be a growth area for Ukraine. The Kyiv Post reported that 13 Ukraine-based IT companies were on the 2017 list of the top tech firms. The International Association of Outsourcing Professionals issues an annual Global Outsourcing 100 list. This year, EPM Systems, Luxoft, SoftServe, Cyclum, Intetix, Team International Services, and Softjourn were among the leaders. They all have R&D offices in Ukraine. This week, Ukraine commemorates the 3rd anniversary of Maidan, when events came to a head on the 18th, 19th, and 20th of February, when there were snipers shooting at the protesters and quite a number of deaths. Today's guest in the Ukraine Calling studio is Dr. Mykhailo Vinitsky, sociologist from Kyiv Mohyla University. He's an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and director of the doctoral program. He also works with the Ukrainian Catholic University Business School in Lviv. Raised in Canada, but he has been living in Kyiv for many years, and he was here through the events of Maidan. So I've asked him in to share his insights with us on Ukraine today, 3 years after those events. So welcome.
Thank you.
Mykhailo, you were there on the Maidan 3 years ago, in fact, reporting from the Maidan. So what are the strongest memories that have remained with you to this day?
Well, the simple answer to that one is the strongest memory is witnessing someone get shot on the on February 19th, about 3 meters away from me. That actually wasn't a it wasn't a sniper shooting. That was because I saw the guy that did the shooting, and I saw the guy fall beside me. It was at the time when Maidan was cut in half, basically, where the Berkut forces had moved forward and basically actually gotten all the way up to the Stella Monument. And one of the, I loathe to call them police officers, but one of the officers in a flak jacket popped out from behind the Stella Monument, the Monument to Independence, and shot from a pump action shotgun. And the guy that was standing beside me, like I said, about 3 meters away, fell. And it was at that point that I understood that it was probably time for me to leave. That's probably the most sort of poignant memory, but it's a very negative memory. And in fact, I don't want to focus on the negative, because Maidan was very much a time of the 3 months of protests was very much a time of sort of, I guess, uplifting and an emotional roller coaster. It was a time of national resurgence. It was a time of people power. And it was a place where you went to, because everybody was welcome. I hate to sort of use the Cheers analogy of, you know, everybody knows your name. It wasn't like that. It was just a
solidarity.
Solidarity and a feeling of being alive. I think that's probably the most important thing. Every person that was on Maidan felt that he mattered, he or she mattered. You know, there were signs that we put up, and that was, please excuse the inconvenience, we're changing the country. And that was kind of the... That was the feeling, that everybody was there to change the country, and we were there to do it together. With one of the things I find as a sociologist most interesting is it was a leaderless kind of movement, because we rejected the leaders. and were very skeptical of Yatsenyuk, Tikhonov, and Klitschko, and Poroshenko. But nevertheless,
I was actually thinking that was a lot of Westerners were wondering at this Ukrainians' knack for self-organizing.
Yeah, I think that this is actually something that we're starting to see now as a worldwide process. Ukraine was probably one of the first. I mean, obviously, the Arab Spring is a very similar kind of protest movement, which is also was basically leaderless. We're seeing protests in Korea at this point. We're seeing protests in Romania. And in every single case, we're seeing sort of people rise up. Usually, by the way, corruption is a very good rallying call for these types of protests. And in other words, they're anti-corruption protests very often. But they tend to be very flat, very leaderless, very network oriented. And I think Ukrainians were probably some of the pioneers of that. But I think it's becoming, we're seeing a worldwide movement that I, as a sociologist, find very interesting. And I think that's something that worth studying more. But that's not really what we're here to talk about. I think the skepticism of leaders on Maidan was something that has carried over the last 3 years as well. And unfortunately, there's been a tendency of, you know, many of the Maidan activists have gone into government and have tried to do something in terms of reforms. Some have been more successful, some have been less successful. But the one thing that they all talk about, because I we're in a sort of a circle of friends there that we sort of interact on a regular basis. And one of the things that everybody talks about is the fact that as soon as you go into the offices of power, even if you have the best of intentions, as soon as you go into government, you're considered to be, well, you've crossed to the dark side. There's a lot of skepticism from everyone around. For the first 2 minutes, people are saying, ah, yeah, good, finally we'll see some changes. And then 5 minutes later, you're the enemy. I think the skepticism of Ukrainians towards government is something that is something that we need to work on.
Yeah. But still, going back to the time of the Maidan, what did you observe? What kind of habits and methods that activists adopted on the Maidan? What propelled them to achieve?
One of the things we talked about at the time was that Maidan was like a siege. In other words, it's like the recreation of the Cossack fortress. Yeah, where everybody had something to do. And it was very, very important that everybody find themselves something to do. It wasn't necessarily that someone was supposed to tell you what to do, but that people sort of found there was an awful lot of work to do. So people found something to do. There was always, whether it was standing on the barricades, whether it was building the barricades, whether it was slicing sausages for sandwiches, whether it was bringing firewood for heating, whatever it was, there was always something to do. And within the barricades, it was very much sort of an insular kind of environment where you felt safe, first of all. And secondly, you felt needed. And that was something that was very important. The stage, in fact, which is really was sort of the focal point, was only the focal point for a little while. In other words, from about sort of 7 to 9 in the evening when the speeches were on. But there was a lot more of a dynamic around Maidan because there was usually up to 10 to 15,000 people that were literally living on Maidan for 3 months. I mean, they weren't there for 3 months constantly. People would come in for a couple of weeks, go home, go back to their jobs, come in for a week again. So there was a rotation of people and no one was organizing this. It was all self-organized, which was really something that I think is really, at the time, we thought was pretty unique. Like I said, I think we're seeing this being a sort of a trend now in other countries
as
well.
And you see that continuing in this kind of organization that has, you're saying it's gone into people working in government, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that the major thing that has come out of Maidan is the birth of civil society. And this is something that we talked about, the Orange Revolution is supposedly being the birth of civil society. But in fact, the birth of civil society organizations didn't really happen as the civil society organizations that existed in the Orange Revolution were really, they were very often funded by Western organizations, or they were sort of very small. They were kind of small businesses that were hiding behind the label of NGO. Today, we actually see real volunteer organizations. Now, whether that's a factor of the war, whether that's a factor of Maidan, whether it's sort of the both of them coming together, obviously, you know, demand breeds supply. So if you have a war going on, you need to have volunteers. If you have a Maidan protest going on, you have to have a volunteer movement that's going to feed that protest. And that's something that has happened. But the amazing thing is that it has been sustained. So it's not something that, you know, we got together on Maidan, we protested for 3 months, then after that, we all went home. We didn't. People continued in various organizations. Sometimes those organizations fight against each other. Sometimes they think that one of the issues is that we're starting to see a little bit of a destructive discourse, unfortunately, 3 years later. And the reason is because obviously when you have various organizations, people don't always agree. And I think that there's a lot of frustration because people had higher expectations of change. Obviously, a lot has changed in the country, but there are higher expectations, as there always would be, because if you've got a protest movement, everybody's very maximalist and you want to create, you know, like I said, we had this idea that we were changing the country and therefore we're going to change the country tomorrow. Well, country of 40 million people doesn't change overnight, particularly when it's at war. But the changes are happening.
So what do you think is like a reasonable, can you compare it to other situations?
Absolutely. Revolutions, we have for some reason, we think of revolutions as being a sort of an event. Well, the American Revolution started with the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it took 13 years to get to the Constitution. The French Revolution started with the storming of the Bastille. It didn't end there. It ended, unfortunately, with Napoleon after going through a whole bunch of guillotines and Robespierre, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that revolutions are processes. These are not something that – this is not really – I mean, Maidan was a culminating event that will be remembered in history as something that unfortunately ended with 100 deaths. Or a little more than 100 deaths. But the reality is that after those 100 deaths came 10,000 deaths, and that the process continues in a war, but it also continues internally in the country. We've had massive changes in some areas, and we've had no changes in other areas. We've had massive changes in the fact that we now have a police force that we can actually trust, which is pretty amazing given where we were 4 years ago, where people would sort of hide from the police because the police were the enemy. We have we have changes happening in the school system, which I think are very long-term changes. And these are changes that are, I mean, obviously I've had some input into the university system changes and the autonomization of universities and the changing of PhD systems. But these are things that obviously people wouldn't recognize because, first of all, they'll take a while to have an effect. We're ongoing changes right now in the school system, which I think are very positive, bringing in a new school program, what's called Nova Ukrainska Shkola. These are some of the things that I can mention. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of other things that are army-related and defense-related, which are very, very positive. If we talk about the police force being a very positive thing, we can also talk about the court system not changing being a very negative thing. So, you know, we now have a police force we trust, but judges we don't trust. So we're kind of halfway between where we want to be and where we came from. I mean, the revolution is a process. It'll take some time. We have very positive changes. What we need to remember is that the climax was really the start of the process. It wasn't something that was, you know, bang, February 22nd, Yanukovych was gone and we live in a new country. It certainly felt that way, but long term, that's not the way changes happen.
Yeah, indeed. So we're still, as you're saying, Ukraine is still in this process. And then you have some people being very dissatisfied. Mm-hmm. They perceive that things are not happening. Some, on the other hand, would say it can point out things that, you know, have been successful changes. So some people, it's for the glass is half empty. For mm-hmm. some, it's half full. Mm-hmm. So what do you think people feel overall? Has this revolution, if I can say it that way, has it been successful or not?
Apparently, there's this urban myth about someone walking up to Mao Zedong and asking him his opinion of the French Revolution, and he said that not enough time has passed to be able to make a determination. I really do think that not enough time has passed to make a determination as to whether or not we've been successful. I think we're on the right track. It's we're in year three of probably a decade long process. We've had something that surprised the world. We've had two elections. We changed parliament. We changed presidents. We have been able to build an army of 150,000 people that has stopped Russian aggression. Yeah, we've lost some territory. The war is something that is taking up an awful lot of people's minds, and for rightly reasons, because we've had 10,000 deaths. We don't necessarily talk about the numbers of injured. I came back from Kharkiv last night. I was traveling with a soldier And you know, sergeant who's been in the war zone. He was there for a year, and then he sort of demobilized, and now he's back, signed a contract again. He's in Avdiivka. January 10th, shell hit him in the back, punctured his foot. A month and a half later, Monday, he's back on the line. There are thousands and literally tens of thousands of stories like that, and it has literally touched every single family. Everybody understands that that's Putin, but at the same time, everybody also understands that that is part of the Maidan story. And you can't get away from the war without talking about the Maidan, or you can't talk about the war without talking about the Maidan. So it's all part of one process. So there's a lot of frustration. Obviously, it's touched every single family. People are involved in volunteer work. People are involved in helping the war effort. People are frustrated because we were promised that the territory would be taken back. Now there's a question of, do we take it back? Do we not take it back? Do we freeze the conflict? There's a whole variety of different things that are there. At the end of the day, also, people's lives have gotten worse, meaning economically. You know, you don't devalue a currency three times without everybody feeling this in their pocketbooks. Clearly, people are frustrated, and that is somewhat dangerous, because obviously frustration can turn into violence. But I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're at that stage. I think we do have enough positive things going on around us. And the new elites, the activists that have come out of Maidan, they're still optimistic enough to be able to pull this through. And I think that that's something that's very important. I'm, by the way, one of the optimists. So I'm an incurable optimist when it comes to Ukraine.
So and maybe one of those people that we're waiting for here.
Well, Oksana, you know full well the whole story there. So it's I don't think we need to get into that.
So from your perspective, your optimistic perspective, what do you see? What do you think would be one change that would be most convincing for ordinary Ukrainians that, you know, really things are changing?
I think that we're always looking for a silver bullet, you know, one thing changes and, oh, everybody, and the Maidan was a success. I think that there's a variety of things that have to happen. And again, we got to get into this process logic. A lot of Ukrainians are looking for, finally, I mean, look, it started as Euromaidan. We weren't Euromaidan at the end of it, but it started as Euromaidan. And you know what? At the end of the day, visa-free regime is something that we've earned. So that would be a major, major step. And you know, the ability to travel, the ability to see other countries without going through this really degrading process of getting a visa, I think that's important. I think that the court system needs to change. But again, is the court system going to affect the average person? Probably not. The average person is going to be affected by an improvement in their economic lot. And I think that one of the things that we're seeing happening now, very important, school reform, healthcare reform. But in addition to that, we're actually starting to see the economy grow. The last quarter of 2016, we actually had economic growth, and it was pretty significant. It was at a range of about 5%. 2017 is going to be a year, finally, of growth, which means that people will start seeing some, I mean, the average guy on the street is going to start seeing that, hey, things are getting a little better. They're not going to get better overnight. Ukrainians are wonderful at complaining. I think that that's something that's part of the genetic code of every single Ukrainian, by the way, throughout the world. Everything is really bad, and we love talking about how bad things are. I'm the opposite. I see things that are moving in the right direction. This is a very different country than it was 3.5 years ago. It's a country that understands its own identity. It's a country that is proud of that identity. And that's part of the sacrifice of Maidan. It's no longer a victim culture, which I think is very important, which we used to have because of Holodomor, because of the Second World War, because of a lot of things in our history. We had a victim culture. We're not a victim culture anymore. We're a pride culture. We're a culture where we are proud of who we are, and that's something that we need to build on. We've got a lot of things that we can be proud of, and yeah, people make sacrifices for that identity, for that solidarity, for that ability to be proud later on. And I think that puts a huge amount of responsibility on us. We need to build this country, and I think that there's a lot of internal will in the Maidan activists, people that lived through the night of February 18th, 19th, and then 19th to 20th, people that decided that they were going to take responsibility upon themselves after that and have continued to do that. There's a lot of success stories. We need to communicate them better. Mm.
So will this, will these thoughts and insights also be appearing in your new book? I hear that you
yeah,
mentioned.
Yeah, I'm desperately trying to finish. I have two colleagues of mine that are also academics that have just come out with their books. Taras Kuzio just announced his, and Alexander Motil has just announced his. So I'm trying to get mine to print by Easter, and that means that hopefully it'll be out by Christmas, because these things do take a little bit of time. I'm behind the curve. But
do you have a title?
Yes, the book will be called, very simple, Revolution and War, and it will be about the Maidan and the first 2.5 years after Maidan, so till the end of 2016, about the reforms that have happened in Ukraine. But things that we have personally lived through, and also a little bit of analysis.
Mm, so I'm looking forward to reading this.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to finishing it.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and ideas.
Thanks, Oksana. Thanks for having me.
And now a few highlights from culture in Ukraine. This week saw the international cinema release of Bitter Harvest, a romantic drama set in Ukraine during the time of the Great Famine of 1933. The story is about love, rebellion, and survival in very dangerous times. It is the first major dramatic film which portrays the mostly unknown events of 1930s Stalinist Ukraine, such as the tragedy of the Holodomor, during which millions perished by starvation. The making of the film was financed by Canadian producer Ian Ignatovich, directed by a Canadian, and screened by also by a Canadian. Major roles are played by rising young British actors Max Irons and Samantha Bax, as well as veteran actors. The film was made with a Ukrainian and international film crew. This week, Ukrainians also marked the birth date of Kazimir Malevich. He was born on the 23rd of February, 1878, near Kyiv. Malevich was the founder of the avant-garde suprematist movement and a pioneer of geometric abstract art. His most famous painting is The Black Square. Malevich grew up in Ukraine and worked in Kyiv during the late 1920s. Although he is known as a Russian avant-garde artist, Ukrainian art historians are now discovering how Malevich's art had its roots in traditional Ukrainian culture. And as for this week's music, here's a song for you. It's called Apotheos Vini, which means the apotheosis of war, written and performed by Boris Sevastianov.
Замість слова вмирати всі скажемо жити, замість убити, народити, замість знищити, відновити, але знову літають смертельні квіти, гинуть цивільні жінки і діти, безумна країна загрожує світу, не треба чекати, її треба спити.
Не лишилось нічого, тільки спалена земля, навіть чорні круки не літають, це війна.
У 20-му столітті точилися війни, що несли лихоліття. Здавалося б, уроки засвоєні, але чому тоді усі у світі так занепокоєні? Бо ціла країна, незадоволена розум, сидить у вогні і кидається погрозами, і тягне усіх у свій кам'яний вік, несе із собою смерть і бій.
Не лишилось нічого, тільки спалена земля, навіть чорні круки не літають. Це війни. Thank you.
меншо, ми раді всі скажемо жити, замість убити, народити, замість знищити, відновити, але знову літає смертельні квіти, гинуть цивільні жінки і діти, безумна країна загрожує світу, не треба чекати, її треба змінити. Не лишилось нічого, тільки спали на земля, навіть чорні круки не літають, це війни.
In looking forward, next week will mark the beginning of Russia's stealth invasion of Ukraine. We'll be looking back at those events and what has followed, as well as other stories. Tune in for a new episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Oksana Smerechuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.